Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Psychobetical Podcast. It's me, Andy Kirkpatrick, back again. And this is an emergency podcast. I'm having to do this early in the morning. Like, you might be able to hear my son downstairs, like, being a pain. So the two reasons why this is an emergency podcast. First of all is, in my last podcast, I made two mistakes. One of the mistakes was I said that the Carron Tool is the highest mountain in the British Isles. I'm saying British Isles as in Ireland and Britain, and which is not true. It's higher than Helvellyn. Not as high as the Scafell Pike. Oh, I've been away so long, I can't remember what the highest mountain is in England. So it's definitely higher than Kinderscout. And is it higher than Snowdon? Is Snowdon not as high? Anyway, it's fucking high, but it's not as high as Ben Nevis. So I just need to point that out. I think the reason is I get confused with the difference between like England and Great Britain and all that kind of stuff. But Carron Tool, if that's what it's called, is I highly recommend you take a trip over to Kerry and go and climb Carron Tool, and there's lots of great stuff to do there. If you're into films, if you're a film buff, you need to get a copy of the book about the making of Ryan's Daughter, which is just a great book. If you're not into films, doesn't matter. If you've not seen Ryan's Daughter, that doesn't matter either. And it's really good, but it was filmed around Dingle and along the sea cliffs and stuff around there. And it's just a really interesting book about the power of nature and, you know, this, David Lean, you know, like the world's greatest film director, who'd made, you know, Far From the Maddening Crowd and Lawrence of Arabia and, you know, Bridge Over the River Kwai. Like, he comes to Ireland to make this film, and, you know, Ireland in then must have been really kind of the back and beyond. And he starts making this film, and it's got all this, you know, Hollywood stuff, and you've got A-listers, it's got Robert Mitchum living in Dingle and all this kind of stuff. And it's just like, what happens? And it kind of destroys David Lean, kind of destroys Robert Mitchum, and none of them were really ever the same again after it. There's a really good description where he managed to get all these like young Irish actors who were like, you know, the best theatre actors in Ireland, these young guys, and the first shot of the film is these guys who are playing like IRA, you know, kind of Republicans, sort of coming, you know. I've not actually seen the film since I was a kid, so I don't know. There's something like the row ashore in a boat, and they've got explosives or something, and they're going through the storm, and they get to the village, and they open the door, and they go into the pub. So that was the first film, the first bit of footage they filmed, and these were like young actors, you know, like, you know, young hardy looking Irishmen, and then the bit where they actually came into the pub was filmed about a year and a half later, and by then they'd basically been paid to sit around for a year and a half not doing anything at all. And all he did was just sit in the pub, just like drinking, you know, drinking every day and getting, you know, basically all dying of much younger than they should have of like psoriasis and stuff. So, you know, the shot of them actually coming through the pub, there's these like, you know, fat, bloated old men like come through the door into the pub. So, but there's like so many great stories about the dynamics of all the people working in the film. And Robert Mitchum like grew his own like cannabis in the back. He basically just took over a whole hotel. He just took the whole hotel over and kicked everybody out and lived in this hotel. And it was like crazy sort of party times. And so yeah, it gives a real good sense of the, you know, of the place. And he describes how everywhere you went, you go into the butchers and there'd be like somewhere you could buy a beer, you know, everywhere you went, every shop had somewhere where you could buy beer. So you could have like a, you know, you could get in your sausages made and you could have a pint of Guinness at the same time. So I highly recommend it. Anyway, so I do apologize to the Scots. And I think it's just because Irish people just keep going on about this mountain being like super high and, oh, it's higher than, you know, blah, blah, blah. So it's not my fault. I'm not really into, I'm not a really detail orientated person. So like I always say, you should never climb a mountain you can't spell. And I don't know how to spell Karen Tool, but I have climbed it. So yeah. So my other thing is a little bit more serious. So I had an email this morning, from Rick, and in my last podcast I was talking about single skin tents and about running a stove inside a tent. I think in earlier podcasts I've mentioned about this, about carbon monoxide poisoning and about elevating your pan above the flame higher than normal, like a few centimeters above normal, so you don't get carbon monoxide poisoning. And I kind of mentioned about running the stove, just running the stove with nothing on it in order to generate some heat, like if it's like super, super cold. And so anyway, this is from, I'll read it out. This is what Rick said. In your latest podcast, you talk about using stoves in cold climates and the benefits of petrol stoves over gas stoves. I completely agree with your advice that petrol stoves are effective at heating tents and drying equipment against using gas stoves. You also lightly touched on carbon monoxide poisoning when using stoves within tents, and I've noticed you covered stoves on a few other podcasts regarding Denali tips. Tragically, whilst deployed in Norway with the Royal Marines in the early 90s, we had three guys die in one tent from carbon monoxide poisoning. Like many other climbers, I find your advice very useful and reckon there's an opportunity to add a caveat when you next respond to questions regarding the use of petrol stoves in tents. In short, the guys that succumbed to CO poisoning were waiting in a four-man tent for the weather to improve to do some live firing, and were using a peak multi-fuel stove burning naphtha to keep warm. From recollection and my understanding, they were running the stove on a low heat setting, and over time the stove started to lose pressure. The burn then became too rich, producing excessive amounts of carbon monoxide. So yes, I agree. Petrol stoves are great for heating tents as long as you burn an ideal mix. The fuel is pressurized, and very importantly, fatigued users are vigilant to the effects of carbon monoxide. So yeah, so that's a very good point. I'm writing this book at the moment about top rope soloing for some reason. And when you start going into the weeds of some things, there's so many variables that play a part in something going wrong. It's a bit like a plane crash. You know, it's never just one thing that goes wrong that causes a plane crash. It's always, you know, several things all align at the same time. And you can imagine a tent that has like snow valances on that's been completely buried into the snow, or perhaps even buried in the snow. So there's basically no air coming into that tent, and you're inside the tent and you completely seal it up and you're running this stove. not only do you have the problem of carbon monoxide, you've also got the problem that you're just basically burning up all the oxygen in the tent as well. Because you know, there's no way any oxygen coming into a tent that's completely buried in the snow. It's the same, you know, it's the same problem you have in a snow hole, that you just, you know, you just basically run out of oxygen and you're pumping all this carbon monoxide in. So I guess in the past, whenever the classic people die when they use they put a barbecue, you know, one of those like disposable barbecues, they bring it into a tent to try and, or into a caravan to try and warm up, and it kills them because it's just producing so much carbon monoxide. And in the past, when I've used stoves to dry stuff out, you know, they're generally either in like a portal edge, which is not very, you know, there's plenty of places for the air to you know, waft around in there, or in a tent, and generally, again, you're always conscious you don't want to run out of oxygen, so you generally, even if you're producing heat, you know, you're not trying to make a sauna, so you always have the door undone, and you have like a flow of air, and you kind of being aware of it. But it's one of those, it's one of those tricky things that if you were to say, you know, if you were saying you went up into the Arctic and you're like, or one person's saying like, well, I think we should like bring the stove right into the middle of the tent, you know, right into the center of the tent, and we'll run it, you know, we'll dry our kit out, and we'll, you know, it'll improve our morale, and we'll do all our cooking like right in the middle of the tent. Like, I mean, right in the middle of the tent. You know, the benefits of that would be massive. You know, it might make a massive difference, as in you might be more successful in what you're going to do, and you'll definitely be a lot more comfortable and everything else. Where somebody else who's like, well, I'm not going to bring I'm going to sit outside in the wind and the snow because I read that you weren't supposed to put the stove inside a tent because it's dangerous, and you know, I'm going to follow the rules, and I'm just going to get into this like frozen, you know, increasingly more frozen ice palace every night and just, you know, shiver my ass off and probably just die of, if I don't die of hypothermia, I'll die of, you know, of misery, and I'll just kill myself. So it is one of those. It is one of those things that someone was asking me. I should actually go through. Someone was asking me some questions about the climbing the nose. I wanted to climb the nose, and they were like firing all these questions at me. And let's see if I can find it. It might be informative to what we're talking about. It's really hard to give like an answer that's like, if I was a manufacturer, you know, and I have sort of liability, and I probably maybe have liability anyway, but you know, if you're giving sort of advice that one day may like, you know, land you in court, then you know, you have to give it advice which is almost like not advice. You know, it's a tricky thing. So you're trying to, when you're trying to be, it's not about being honest, but it's just about being like, well, this is what I do. You know, if someone says, can you jumar up a 6mm rope? It's like, well, I have done, but I wouldn't necessarily recommend it. You know, you couldn't, you know, someone couldn't be like, well, Andy said I could, because you don't know like what kind of 6mm, what is it, 6mm accessory cord, is it 6mm Dyneema, is it 6mm, you know, like what kind of sheath is it, is it just is it polypropylene, you know, what is it? So with all these things, you have to sort of apply, you know, some kind of, you just got to think like, well, this person said this, but he's not I'm not a mountain guide or something, so you know, whatever I say is not necessarily you know, trustworthy. Like, I don't even know the highest mountain in the British Isles. So I wonder if it's maybe it's quite too, it's too long, but it was like loads of questions backwards and forwards about how to climb the nose, and And they went up and they tried it and they failed and they came back down again. And so I think in one, they were asking about why you should back up a micro traction. Micro traction. When you're hauling, because it seemed like overkill. Why would you bother? So when you back it up, it just means you. So you got your micro traction clipped into the B layer that you would just clip a quick draw into the rope as well. So if the micro traction was to just explode into nothingness, then the rope would like fall down onto the quick draw. So you wouldn't just like. So if you were hauling along and the micro traction broke, what would happen was the whole weight of the haul bag would fall onto your harness, and it'd not be ideal. Like you talk about escaping the system, like escaping the system with a 100-kilo haul bag hanging off your harness. You probably just have to. It'd be a very tricky situation. You'd have to, if you're there by yourself, if your partner wasn't there, and if you were space hauling, which meant that there was another person on the other end of the whole line, so you had like 200 kilos hanging off of you, and one of them was a person, then you'd be really screwed, because at least the haul bag, you could always cut the rope and let the haul bag fall if you had to, if you're going to die otherwise. But if there's somebody else on the other end of the rope, then that's not a good option. So anyway, so he was asking about why you would bother, because it seemed pointless. Like if you look at micro traction, it's like, how is that gonna break? It's got these two pieces of aluminium, where you clip the two plates on either side, and how is that gonna break? So I said, he said, out of interest, do you personally back up your micro tracks with a quick draw whilst hauling? It seems a bit OTT. You wouldn't do that during crevasse rescue, for example. And I said, if you're just hauling a bag, then no. If you're space hauling, yes. And then he replied, do they actually break though, or is it just a throwback to the more Heath Robinson devices like wall haulers? So wall haulers, like the Rock Exotica wall hauler, which was like the original project, progress capture, integrated pulley sender kind of thing, is that was actually if you put a lot of weight through it, like the actual arm that the cam was on would actually start twisting, and I can imagine it would break off, but it wasn't, if you put like a massive amount of weight through it, it didn't look very happy about it. So I replied, like, on a wall, you have so many things that can fuck you up. It's worth being extra paranoid, especially if it will kill you. With a pro traction, you need to always put a crab into the bottom hole. This can open up if you've not locked it down. In brackets, it's happened. You'd probably not space haul on a micro traction, but if you got 150 kilograms in your bags and two people hauling on the other side, that's a lot of force on the pulley, which might be strong enough when brand new. But what about after 10 years and lots of abuse? What happens if the locker gets forced open, which can easily happen on a messy belay, and gets twisted and loaded over the edge, and the crab breaks? Or you'll have a zillion crabs on a big wall, so why not back it up? So that's an interesting point I'm trying to make there, which is, people look at something and they'll say, oh, look at this Kevlar cord, like a 9mm, like a soft link. I don't know if you know what a soft link is. A soft link is it's like a loop that you can open, but you have basically 100% of the strength of the loop. So it would that be stronger than a sewn sling? Anyway, it's fucking strong. Like I think a 9mm loop of soft link is like a, maybe it's like 130 kilonewtons breaking strength, though. Pretty damn strong. But that's when it's brand new, straight out of the factory. So, you know, if you've had that, you know, if you, how well did you tie it? How well have you like made up this this soft link? If you made it yourself, like how good is your, you know, is your ability to, you know, to make that, to make a soft link? And then what, how good is it when you've had it for maybe, you know, 5 years and you've, you know, it's been used a lot, it's been, you know, using, got wet and got dry and been left somewhere hot in a hot car, and you just never really know. I think it goes across the board. Like I was reading how even say something like the old COVID vaccine was supposed to be like 70% mRNA, or it is, but the one that actually came out was only 50% or something. So the things, like things change. So when you see the statistics or the strength or something of something, you know, that really is the, you know, what it was on the day in the factory, and it doesn't always transfer that well to the real world. Like if you look at, you know, how a carabiner is tested, you know, you've got minor axis and major axis and all that kind of stuff, right? You know, you got your cross loading, everything else, but you don't really have any testing for the carabiner like going over an edge or something. Like there was a photograph of someone found a wire gate carabiner on the bottom of El Cap, which was completely twisted. So the gate was facing in the opposite direction to the nose of the carabiner. Now, like there was, like it's, I don't know, but there was, two climbers were killed speed climbing. Was it last year, year before? And I kind of hypothesized that what could have happened was basically they were moving together and one of them fell, and the rope was probably only attached to the belay. They probably were short fixing. So one person, you know, climbs up to the belay and just pulls up the rope so it's tight, ties a clove hitch into it, clips into a carabiner, and then starts soloing the next pitch with a big loop of rope. And then the other person jumars up, and when they reach the belay, by then hopefully the other person has got some protection in or whatever, or they put them on belay and blah blah blah. So I kind of hypothesized that what happened was one of them fell, the leader fell, and the carabiner broke or became detached from the rope, and the both of them fell to the bottom of El Cap and died. So I had a hypothesis that potentially, you know, when you tie the, you know, if the carabiner was to shift before the person, so you clip this carabiner in into the bolt. You pull up the rope so it's tight to the second. You tie a clove hitch. You clip it into the thing, and then you start climbing. But when you start, so you're climbing away from this carabiner with a big loop of rope, and your second has not weighted the rope yet because they're now quickly putting on the jumars and whatever. Now in that time, it'd be very easy for the carabiner, like, because this potentially is just a snap gate carabiner, it's not even a locker, is the carabiner would shift into a certain direction, the clove hitch would move along, so the clove hitch was actually pulling on the nose of the carabiner, and the person weights the rope, and that locks the clove hitch in place on the nose of the carabiner, not along the spine. And then the leader falls while the other person's waiting the knot, and then, you know, you have the weight of the dead weight of the climber and dead weight of the leader falling onto that thing, and it'd be enough to break a carabiner, could easily break a carabiner doing like that. So you know, so when you see this carabiner, it's completely twisted around. It's like, wow, like there's no test for anything like that. So like most gear is very, very strong, but it's only designed to be strong in the optimal kind of loading. So if you have like a suboptimal loading, then you don't really know what's going to happen. And it's amazing, you know, I've seen people like bounce test something and the carabiner's broken, like the or they've bounce tested something, and when they looked at the carabiner, basically the gate just went backwards and forwards because the nose of the carabiner as they were loading it, the gate has fluttered, so it wasn't engaged with the nose, and the nose is bent out, so you have this carabiner that's kind of bending and will eventually break. So you have to be like, as I said, like you have to be kind of paranoid about this kind of stuff. It's not worth being like totally trusting of everything. It's all like sometimes when you're space hauling, I've been space hauling where you've got a massive amount of weight, like maybe you've got like 200 kilos, like you're really at the maximum load you can put on a protraction. Like the problem with all the pulleys is it's to do with the amount of force that the eccentric cam can place on the rope without damaging it, which is probably about 400 kilos. So it's not about the pulley itself. Like the pulley is basically, you're not going to break the pulley. It's like really, really strong. But if you're putting like 400 kilos of force on the rope, you could like, you know, the sheath could break, and then that, you don't know what's really going to happen then when that starts happening. So, you know, but you've got like 200 kilos on one side of the haul line, and on the other side you've got two climbers as counterweight, and then you're hauling as well. So the force like going through the system is like massive, and that's why you're often better doing like double haul. So you'll have like two haul lines, and you release the bags, and you've basically got two haul lines hanging down with like bags on each one of them, and you'll haul them up one after the other, and that's actually a lot safer, and it can actually be quicker, because one person, you know, if you're like a two person team and you're going to be on a wall for like 10 days, it means that every single belay, it requires two people to haul the bags up. If you're going to have to space haul, like space hauling is basically using one person's a counterweight to the haul bags. So as you're hauling, that person's going down, and then they jumar up, go down, jumar up. So if you're going, but if you have two separate haul lines, so what you do is the leader leads with a zip line, which is like a thin rope. And when they get to the belay, they pull up the two haul lines on the end of that rope. And then you'd put one through the pulley, the protraction, ready to haul that bag. And then the other one, you put it on a munter hitch and then tie it off like a mule thingy, what do you call it? So it's releasable. So the second cleans the pitch, gets to you. You could be hauling as they're cleaning the pitch, hauling one of the bags. You give them the lead rope, you give them the zip line, and they can start leading the next pitch while you're still hauling. So when you get the first haul bag up, you tie it off, and then you put the you attach your clip a jumar into the rope, the second rope that you're going to lower that's releasable. You clip a jumar into that, you release it so it's on the jumar, then you put the pulley into the slack rope you have now above the jumar, clip that in, start hauling, take the jumar off, and away you go. So it's actually good. It's a good way of doing it. That's how I've done it sometimes when I've been soloing, is just do two hauls at the start. You can do like a 3-to-1 and everything else, but if the bags are getting that heavy, you have to start worrying about, you know, what damage you could do to the, you know, can the pulley actually take that much weight? Like I've used like a 6-to-1 and all sorts of, you know, other shenanigans, but you know, you're kind of limited by the device, really. So I guess that back to the tent thing is, you know, that's is the same thing, really. Is like using a stove in a tent is not an ideal situation for obvious reasons. So you have to, you know, you have to kind of understand, you know, there's like, again, it's the same with like the pulley thing. There's like so many bad things that could happen. You could have a fuel leak inside your tent, which will burn your tent down. You could have, you know, you can like just simple things like knocking over water, like boiling water is you could end up with like serious injury to somebody, but you could also end up with all your kit being like piss wet through. So that's, you know, that could lead to, you know, that could be a catastrophic thing as well. So yeah, you have to really be on the game. Like if you're ever on an expedition, you always have to have like a stove board, which is like a piece of wood, piece of like thin plywood. And, you know, it's kind of the zone where by having a board, it's like a flat, you know, flat surface. So it's less likely to get knocked over or banged, but it also kind of creates like a space where nothing can, you know, that's, you just don't go near that board. You kind of stay away from it. Where if you're trying to balance a stove straight onto the fly sheet, onto a carry mat, which is not a good idea because it'll set on fire, is, you know, you're just asking for someone to knock something. That's a good reason why creating like a housing, like a Trangia style rigid, you know, thing that the pan fits in and the stove goes in is like another really good idea, because just, again, it creates just more stability. You're not going to easily knock the water over. Going to create like a bit of a separation. It's very easy for things to sort of drift into the flame of a stove and get set on fire. And then when one's in a snow hole in Patagonia for about a week, I didn't go out the snow hole really for like an entire week, just laid in there. And it wasn't a big snow hole, it was like a coffin. And the stove was like between the two of us, and it was like slowly melting down into the glacier between us. And anyway, one day it like set fire to one of the carry mats, which kind of got over too close to the stove. And you think there's not a lot of oxygen inside a snow hole after a week, but wait till it's full of, you know, you know, burning carry mat sort of stuff. It's not good. So I remember when being on a big wall for ages, and we were using a petrol stove, because it was, I can't remember the petrol stove. I think because it was just more reliable to have a petrol stove than a gas stove. Because early gas stoves, like the Epigas stoves and things, they were always a little bit temperamental, and you had a lot of, you know, you'd be on a route and it would just stop working, which was a pain. So we had like an MSR Dragonfly stove that was like built into a pan, so you could hang it inside a portal edge. And I remember, like, after about a week of it, like when you, if you ever burped or something, you could taste petrol in your mouth, which probably explains a lot of, you know, the years that followed, really. So you're basically doing something hazardous, so you're gonna have to basically, you know, there's hazardous, like, I'm sure if you're flying a jet fighter and using an ejector seat is kind of hazardous, but then you're flying at, you know, high speed, you know, 200 feet off the deck, so it doesn't really, you know, it's all part of the game. So yeah. I'm always coming up with things I should sort of waffle on about, but I can't really think what they are. they always seem like quite important at the time, but I should write. I think David Lynch always says that you should always make notes, because like notes are these bits of amazing kind of sort of creativity and things that come to you, and you think, oh, I'll remember that because it's a really good idea, and then you just kind of forget. So I've had a few emails actually about clarification and things. Like someone was asking about in Down, there's this thing about using a fiddle stick. I think I call it a ghost stick in there. And there's this one where you do an improvised one, and how good is it and stuff. And like, it's the same thing in that, you know, a lot of things. So it's like, do you include this technique, which is a little bit dodgy, that people might find themselves, or do you exclude it because you're not really, you know, it's a little bit dodgy, or do you include it and try and explain like why it's dodgy, but then by including it, people think it must be a good idea or something, or yeah, like you always. There's loads of things that you'd never go out of your way to use. You know, you might just play around with them, but hopefully you'll never use them for, you know, never use them for real. So yeah, so it's always a dilemma. Like, am I gonna get sort of, you know, like someone gonna sue me or something? It's I guess you just have to make sure you don't have any money. I think that's the way forward, I think. So what was it? Someone was asking me the other day. Oh, it's someone in. I went to Softplay. If you know what that is, you're not a parent. Softplay is like where you take your child and they kind of run around. And Noah is not quite two. He's like two next week or something. And he's going through a phase of being sort of pushing people. But pushing people who are like a lot older than he is, like I think maybe have to take it to MMA fighting or something, because he's like we do quite a lot of rough play, would you call it? Because I think it's kind of important. Like I'm trying to bring him up different from my other kids. Like he's not really watched any television, or he doesn't know that a phone you can watch stuff on it, Diggers or whatever. So I've been trying to like. I'm trying to bring up more of like an analog child and be more, you know, physical and all that kind of stuff. Like we had a load of like this house, when this house was built, there was no path built around it. Like in Ireland, you basically have like a concrete, like I guess most houses, you have like concrete path around the outside, and it helps to seal the house, because when the rain comes down, the concrete, you know, it goes down away from the house off the path. But this house never had one, so that's why you get like rats and mice in the house, because they can just like go underneath into the bottom of the house and we'll start wandering around having a good time. So anyway, so we're trying to get that done at the moment. So anyway, so there's a massive delivery of stones, and he was up there like, you know, climbing around on the stones and with his digger and all that kind of stuff. And the weather was horrendous. Like the other day I decided to go down to this hotel down the road from where we live. I was like, I'll go down to this hotel and I'll do some work. You know, I've got to get this book finished. So I started walking down the road, and I've started trying to wear like smarter clothes, because a lot of time I just walk around with my shorts on, like even in the middle of winter, my Crocs and my shorts. Because it doesn't matter if you got wet, because your legs would just dry, you know, you dry quicker. So I was like, well, I was basically walking around like a Kiwi, basically. So anyway, but I decided I would just like a bit like a homeless person half the time. So I decided to start wearing some proper clothes. So I've got some like smarter trousers. I've got some like suede-y boot shoe type things. When my mum died, I had to buy some clothes to look like half decent. So I got a shirt I got in South Africa, like a cowboy shirt. Anyway, so I started because I think people treat you differently. Like if you're sitting in this hotel, you know, if you just look like a tramp, you know, you're like a smelly tramp who's, you know, drying, everything's, all his clothes are wet half the time and just drying the other half the time. You know, people treat you differently. So anyway, so I'm dressing up like a disguise. I remember, actually, I don't know if I've told this story on this podcast, but I once won this award in Italy, in Venice, a translation of Psycho Vertical, and I had to go over there, and I got this €10,000 prize, but I could only get the money if I went there. So I was in the middle of something else. So I had to fly, you know, I had to fly like 6 in the morning. I had to drive somewhere. Basically, I had to drive all night from where I was to this airport, and then get the 6 a.m. flight, and then get to Venice, and then I had to get this thing. They had to leave again at like 9 o'clock, get back in my car, then drive all the way back to this other place. So it was just mad thing. I remember I was trying to get to this airport on the time, and I was dying for a piss. I had to like piss into like a McDonald's cup or something in my car, and then I spilled it on myself, and oh god, I just turned up looking like a fucking tramp, you know, just absolutely. Yeah, you know, just look back on it. Like, God, I was mentally ill, I think. Anyway, so, but I remember being in the airport and like thinking, like, oh my God, like I feel like such a tramp. And look at these Italians; they look amazing. Like, even someone who's, you know, like a homeless person is fucking more stylish than I am. And I was thinking, like, God, what is it? What is it about them? So a few months later, I had to do this talk in London for somebody or other, and I was like, I really hate having to like put on a suit. I had a suit that I bought for getting buried in, and I was like, I really hate dressing like that. Like, I just feel out of place. I was like, why don't I dress like an Italian? So, on the way, I went to Sheffield and I went to like some shop that sold like, you know, fancier clothes, and I just Googled like how to dress like an Italian, and it came up with, you know, what you should wear, and I just basically bought some of these things, and it did actually work. So when I would dress like an Italian if I was talking, because I was kind of casual, but you look kind of, you know, it looked like you'd made a bit of an effort. I think the last talk I did, I think I just turned up in my Crocs. It's like I got these like horrible trousers I got from Walmart, like builder's trousers. I think I'm still mentally ill, because I don't. It's only afterwards I always like, what the fuck were you wearing your Crocs for? Like, you were getting paid. I was getting paid like 1,500 quid. You know, 1,500 quid for like half an hour's work. And I can't even fucking put some fucking shoes on. Like, what's wrong with me? Like, I think one problem is someone told me they once got that guy who does the chimneys. He used to, Fred Dibner. Fred Dibner to do a talk. Some fancy black tie do somewhere. And anyway, Fred Dibner turned up and he had his boiler suit on. It's like his oily boiler suit on for working on steam engines or something. And they're like, Fred, it's like black tie. And he goes like, these are my clothes. So I guess that's it. To be yourself, it's quite a big thing. So what's I talking about? Oh yeah, so I put my fancy-ish clothes on. You wouldn't think they were fancy if you saw me in them, but I put my fancy-ish clothes on and I started walking. It's probably like a mile up the road or something. Started walking up the road and started raining a little bit. So I was only gone about 200 metres, so I better go and get my umbrella. So I went back, I got the umbrella. Oh, yes, I apologise. Got this umbrella. It's a good umbrella, actually. It's like one. It's one of those like indestructible umbrellas, so they say. So I get my umbrella, and I've got a coat on, everything else. I start walking, and then it just started like pissing with rain, and it was like pissing and just crazy rain. There was like the sea was all, see, the sea was crazy, and then all the cars started fucking splashing me as we're driving down, as we're walking along this road, and I was just absolutely fucking soaking. I was like, I'd only gone about half a mile. I was like, oh, this is, I'm not going to sit fucking like a, I'm going to look like a wet tramp, like I've fallen in the sea or something. Like, so I look like I'm some refugee who's ended up on the wrong, you know, floated over to an island or something. So I just turned around and walked all the way back home again and walked back in the house, just like soap, soaking wet. So anyway, I don't know what the point of that story was, but there is no point to it. Oh God, I think Noah's coming. Noah's coming up. I can hear him. He's going to start banging on the door in a minute. Maybe my correction is how long I've been talking for, nearly 50 minutes. I was thinking I need to have some more format to these things. I should have like a book thing, you know, like media corner, we call it, or something. Could have like a new section, couldn't I? Could have a new section, Andy's take on the current news. Someone sent me a message and they said, "Oh God, go away! I'm doing my podcast." Oh, God, he's trying to get in. Yeah, see, that's the thing is, if you don't let your kids watch screens, they get fucking obsessed with them. It's like when your mum and dad don't let you have heroin. Do you know what I mean? Like, they're just creating this future problem. I think that's the problem with pornography. Like, I was telling somebody the other day that when you were a kid, when you were younger, like, everything was more communal. So if someone bought, like, an album, you'd all listen to it. You know, if you got Dex's Midnight Runners album, you know, everyone would be sitting in the front room. They'll be sitting in your bed set listening to Dex's Midnight Runners or Dead Kennedys or something. Like, it was a bit weird, I think, to buy a record and listen to it by yourself, if you know what I mean. You did it, but it was a more of a shared thing. And I was saying that pornography was the same. You know, I remember, you know, like, if someone had some sort of video cassette of some pornography or something, which is kind of weird that it wasn't that more common that back then. Like, pornographic magazines, I don't know who really bought them, but you never saw anybody buying them. And they were you'd only really come across, like, a pornographic magazine, it'd be, like, in a wood or somewhere, like, someone would have, like, you know, some little wank den or something hidden away somewhere. And it made it much more exciting, like, pornography and things, because it was so much more forbidden, and it's a bit like climbing, basically, in England, because the weather in the UK, the weather's so shit that climbing has this, like, proper, it's a bit like pornography in the 70s and 80s. You know, it's much more kind of, oh, what's going on? Like, what does rock feel like? And all that kind of stuff. So even pornography was more, good job my son's not in here, because he might be thinking, God, my son might be listening to this when he's like an old man. And he'd be like, oh, my God, my father. He would be saying, though, like, oh, God, I always thought my father was such a stylish person. So, yeah. This has been a bit, I think because I've had to rush this, it's not been up to my usual high standards of stuff. I have got some, I've got some questions. Like, basically, Vanessa was having, she's going to have this baby in about 2 or 3 weeks. So I'm frantically trying to get this book. There's no way I can finish this book in 2 or 3 weeks, but I'm just trying to get it to some point where I can start. I've got like some beta people who are not beta people, but the people who are going to go through it. But it's been taking a lot longer because what I've been doing is I've been writing it for probably 2 years. I've really not been doing that much writing, so I've been banging that out, and now I've been going through it. But what I've been doing, I've been doing like text to speech, so listening to what it sounds like, and then trying to make it, you know, read better by listening. Because when you spent so long doing something, you can't read it anymore, because what you're reading is what you think it says, not what it really says. So by having like text to speech software, you can actually listen to what it actually says, and that's been really useful. But it probably does take you know, 5 times longer to do anything, because you'd end up really micro. Like, you could just hand it over to someone who could proofread it. But a proofreader can't really proof it for accuracy, or are you trying, you know, what they're really trying to say here. You tend to just focus on spellings and grammar and stuff. So yeah, it's a very slow process, but hopefully it'll be interesting. A lot is about top rope soloing, which is fucking dull as ditch water. It is actually quite interesting, because if I could be asked, I should really expand it into a book about, it should be called Up, and it should be about Jumarring, climbing ropes and stuff. Because basically top rope soloing is about climbing a rope, like Jumarring, rope ascending, blah, blah, blah. So I really, really, if I really could find it in myself to get rid of the top rope soloing bit, or make the top rope soloing bit just part of a book about climbing ropes, then that would be the way to do it. But I just can't bring myself to to, like, with everything, I'd say, like, all I need to do is, I just have to include prussic loops and some stuff like that, and some other methods of climbing ropes, because I kind of covered all the main mechanisms of climbing a rope as part of top rope soloing, but I just don't think I could do it. I think it's just too, I think I've just got too, I think I've got other things I want to get on with. That's nowhere. So I think it's just going to have to be top rope soloing, and maybe I'll just, yeah. It's so easy to get bogged down. I really understand about myself is I have this thing, like, it's like a log jam, like an intellectual log jam, is you begin something and at a certain point you realize you shouldn't be doing it. But if that point comes too far along the road, then you think, yeah, but I have to finish it now. I've spent too much time on it. And it's almost like a feedback loop, is the more you push against something, the harder it becomes to push. You know, the more you're forcing yourself to do something, the harder it is to get to do it. What's that thing about sand? It's like if you push your hand into sand very slowly, you can push it quite deeply. But if you punch the sand, it doesn't get anywhere. So it's a little bit like that. And I have undertaken at least one project. I think that, what's it called, like multi-pitch climbing. I started doing that with somebody. I think it's on Amazon somewhere. I started doing that with David, who I'd met somewhere, and David Coley. But David had basically written almost that entire book, and I just kind of came in at the end to do a little bit. But it just ended up taking forever, and I really didn't enjoy doing it. And I probably just, like, fucked up, you know, all the work he'd done on it. So if you read it, it's all basically David's work, and it's, you know, I'm in there somewhere. But I ended up doing, like, the Kindle version, and oh god, I should learn from these things. But I always think something's not going to take very long. Someone said that's a thing about to do with people who call themselves dyslexic. That's something about time management. You always think everything's going to be take half the time, but it takes a lot longer than you think. So yes, so that's where I'm at. So is that a fire engine? So I think I will leave it there, and I shall save my, I'm still going to be doing these podcasts with other people, but I'm just got a, I was thinking of doing a podcast that had nothing to do with climbing, and I was going to call it Radioactive Dog Shit. What do you think about that title? Nothing to do with climbing, just to do with others, like Kanye West. Like, I'm a great supporter of Kanye West, even though he might be anti-Semitic. But I always think that just all you have to do is anything he says that people think is anti-Semitic, just replace the word Jew with 1%, or, you know, white people, or white men, or whatever, and then just see if it reads differently, and if it does, then you can fuck off. Anyway, so so Kanye West. I never liked Kanye West until he was being, you know, like a pain in the ass to everybody, and I quite like him. I can't even think of any Kanye. I once went on a trip with someone who was like a massive Kanye fan, and I was just like, oh, I just don't get it. Don't get rap music and all that kind of stuff. But I should say this for Radioactive Dog Shit, or rads, yeah. Anyway, I forgot my point now. I think someone like Kanye West, this is my take on Kanye West. Like, Kanye West, people always talk about being woke, but I think they're actually being the opposite of woke. They're actually asleep. They're actually putting themselves to sleep. They already don't understand what's going on in reality anyway, because otherwise they wouldn't be going woke. So they're actually retreating from reality, you know, the fabric of reality, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Objective reality. And so being woke is actually being unwoke, being asleep. But someone like Kanye West is, to my mind, he's someone who is actually waking up. And in the process of waking up, you know, it's very confusing. And you can like this is why people become radicalized. Because the process of waking up or trying to understand what's going on in reality is very, very painful. Are you going? Okay. I mean, I'm just explaining about Kanye West. I'll be there in 1 minute. Okay. I'll come with you. Yes. I just need to put my fancy clothes on. The process of waking up is very, very painful. And you will say and do and think loads of crazy shit and stuff that you will later on try and deny. But you just accept it. You could be racist, Islamophobic, sexist, you know, blah, blah, blah. And ideas will come into your head and they'll make total sense. But they later on they won't. Or you'll just discount them that they're not helpful or whatever. Like, I don't think women should be in, able to be in you know, big governments or politics. Because I think they're just not good at that kind of thing. But they should be. But men shouldn't be in charge of local politics because they're not really good at that kind of thing. So I think, I don't think you should be able to vote unless you pay tax. You know, which is a radical idea. Which if someone told me I'd think that years and years and years ago, I would have thought they were like a right wing asshole. You know, but I just don't think you should be able to. People shouldn't be offer you things. You vote for, that's why, really. So I have lots of really crazy ideas that maybe I won't think that in a few years' time. You know, I'll think that's like a really crazy thing to say. But people should be able to express these craziness. And yeah, they might get destroyed for it. But that doesn't matter because it doesn't matter if ultimately if you're kind of free to think and to express things. Like, between 25% and 50% of all wealth in America is owned by Jewish people, who make up 2% of the population. So, does that mean there's a conspiracy? No, but it means that maybe Kanye West, as a black man, should maybe look at why Jews have done so well in America. You know, so it's that's where he'll end up, hopefully. Instead of thinking that the Jews are trying to take over the world, he might understand why African Americans aren't. So, you know, it's a process. So don't be horrible to Kanye. Don't jump in and say, yeah, I'm never buying Adidas again, blah, blah, blah. So yeah, anyway, I need to go. I've gone off track now. Should have saved that for my other thing. And I do apologise. And until next time, goodbye.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile. And the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.